Life,
a podcast of the cinema.
My name's Dave White.
I'm Alonzo Duraldi.
We are film critics, and we're married, and we're depressed.
Yes. We're going to try to keep it upbeat.
Not always. It's been a very, very unhappy week.
Yes.
The past 8, 7, 6, 9 days. I don't even know how many days it's been now.
And again, as a public service for those tuning in the future, it is June 2nd, 2020, as we record this. And we were already in the middle of a pandemic, but now we have a national crisis around the ongoing problem of police brutality and racism. And sadly, no one is in charge anywhere. Mayors aren't stepping up. Governors aren't stepping up. The president certainly isn't stepping up. And so
he's stepping up to make it worse.
Yes, yes.
He's stepping up to be an ass.
Yes, he is going full fash on us, which is terrible. Not entirely unexpected, but still terrible.
If you if you're new to the show and you are confused by our distaste for that man, that's the show.
Yeah.
I mean, we're film critics. We're going to talk about the current cinema.
We are.
In a moment. We're also going to tell you that we hate Donald Trump and his supporters, his
enablers,
cronies in the government, and
his henchmen,
his family, but everything. We hate everything connected to him. And so, you know, don't listen to us if you don't like that.
you could turn us off right now if any of that is a problem.
We were going to record this yesterday, but... we live in West Hollywood.
Yes.
Which, if you don't know the geography of Los Angeles, is...
not near downtown and not near Santa Monica.
We're right smack in the middle of the beginning of the West Side.
Yeah.
And we are the area that is right next to, right to the east of Beverly Hills.
Right.
And so... there was a big demonstration planned for yesterday at 4 o'clock, and the mayor went wild and was like, "We're curfewing everybody at 1 o'clock. No, 4 o'clock. No, 5 o'clock. No, 6 o'clock." Like, that was confusing. And the National Guard came in, and there were helicopters all over our neighborhood. And because the demonstration is about 4 blocks from our apartment.
And, sirens and the whole thing.
You know,
thing.
Then it got canceled, but people showed up anyway, like thousands of people showed up anyway.
Yeah.
And so we, it was so noisy in our area that we did not record this. And now we're doing it because today is quieter
ish. Yeah. We'll see how it gets later.
Now, if you are a Patreon person, you've been listening to us talk about this for, like, several days now on the 4 other shows that we do.
Yes.
The 4 subscribers. But if this is the only one you listen to, we will just, you know, reiterate that we support Black people in this moment.
Yes.
With every possible way that we can. And what that means to for us is monetarily, because there's a pandemic going on, and I'm, you know, we're old.
We're not in a position to outrun tear gas.
We're not young enough to be all, you know what, I'll live through COVID. Like, and I'm a fat man with a bad back. I cannot outrun a tear gas bump. I just crumple up in a ball. It was also a sit-in. And I was like, I'm trying to imagine...
sitting in the
As I said to one of our young friends, I said, can you imagine me at a sit-in at this point in my life? Like, Alonzo would have to stumble over me to try to pull me up off the ground, and we'd both fall on each other. And he interrupted me, and he said, like when you tried to dance to the Carly Rae Jepsen song in Target and you fell over and you took the whole magazine rack with you, like that time. And I was like, kinda.
Good example.
Yeah. So it's a terrible time right now in the United States, and we have struggled with how to keep doing the content that we do. You know, we do a TV podcast, we do a food podcast on the subscribers get those. And everything feels like it's not important enough to talk about right now.
At the same time, a lot of listeners have been reaching out to us of late talking about,
we're glad you're talking about this inconsequential stuff.
Yes.
But if you go to, you know, our social media, D. Leland White at Twitter and Instagram, A. Duralde at Twitter, and LinoleumCast on Instagram. Is LinoleumCast also on Twitter?
Yes, but I haven't. Okay. I've been sort of.
We've been posting links of resources, things you can do.
Places you can read.
Things you can read, places you can give money to.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you cannot go out and protest, if you are too worried about catching a deadly virus to go out and protest, understandable, there are things that you still can do.
Absolutely.
So, in the meantime, we got some movies to talk about.
We do.
What in the hell are these movies? Where are they? Did we even watch them?
Yeah. At some point.
What did we watch and when?
What seems like a million years ago. Like, I got a text this morning from Christy Lemire, who does the Breakfast All Day podcast with me. And she goes, this feels like a news item from a million years ago.
Yeah.
It was announced today that the zoo formerly owned by the Tiger King...
Oh, that guy.
Is going to Carol Baskin.
Okay, so what does that mean?
His, like, arch nemesis.
All right, I didn't watch this show. Oh. I couldn't bear it.
Anyway, and it's just the sort of thing where, like, a month ago, this would have been all the internet is talking about.
Well,
and today it's just like,
who cares?
Yeah, are we this still? No, we can't. We're not down for this.
Did he have a zoo? Did he buy a zoo?
He bought a zoo. He made a zoo. He created a zoo.
He created a zoo and found all these wild animals to put in it?
Yeah, it's all very shady.
Did he steal them from somebody?
No,
or?
Dave, let's not even talk about this. This is months old.
I've decided not to care.
It was just so weird to get this news item. Like, oh yeah, God, them. Like, that just seems like didn't they have a radio show?
Who's in jail right now?
The Tiger King is in jail.
He's in jail.
For trying to murder this woman.
For trying to murder the lady?
Well,
for
conspiring to hire someone to murder her, yes.
Okay. Great.
So,
fine.
Yeah, that all feels like ancient history at this point.
And she gets to keep these wild animals that are, like, caged against their
Well, she ostensibly has some sort of shelter or whatever. I don't know.
Okay.
It's a whole thing.
This sounds wonderful.
You don't want to know.
I don't. I've already heard too much.
Fine. Yes, we did see some movies.
Hang on, I'm pulling up my list of what we did see.
We saw The High Note.
We did see The High Note. Nisha Ganatra.
Yes.
Directed The High Note.
Yes.
It was supposed to be in movie theaters.
It was.
Now it's on...
Streaming.
Just streaming.
Yeah.
You can rent it for
Amazon, iTunes.
A normal amount of money. Like $20.
I think it might be like $20, actually. Well, it's the same company. It's Universal / Focus, so... I haven't looked, but I suspect that's probably the deal.
Hang on. Pause the recording. I'm going to find out how much it costs to rent...
The High Note.
The High Note.
It is, in fact...
$20.
$20.
I guess, why do I bristle at that so much?
I don't know. That's what...
That's the...
ticket at the Arclight would have been.
It's the going rate at the fancy theaters in Los Angeles.
Yes.
You go to the Grove, you go to, you know, the Arclight, you're going to pay anywhere between... Depending on the time of day and depending on the day. Like, you go on Tuesday morning, it's like $16. You go on Friday night, it's like $20.
Think of it this way. If you're a couple at home and you made your own popcorn.
I understand. I get it. Like, if you're not alone.
Yeah.
And you want to rent this movie, that's two $10 tickets. That's normal. But I got to say... The The film-going experience, the movie theater experience, the way I organize it for myself, is part of the pleasure of that ticket price.
Well, of course.
Because I have arranged my life in such a way that I go to the movie theater when I've calculated that there are as few people there as possible. And you know, websites that allow you to choose your own seat and to know how many other people have already bought tickets for that screening are really helpful.
Sure.
Because if I see that The High Note is playing at the AMC at Century City, and there is only like three other people for this, you know, Tuesday morning matinee, that's my time.
Yeah.
That's my special time. I'm going to go. I'm going to be practically alone. I'm going to get cheese, fried cheese sticks, mozzarella sticks.
Well,
grape soda.
Yeah, and you're paying.
And that's going to be.
You're paying for air conditioning and the bigness.
It's just, you know, that's. I've constructed my version of this pleasure.
Right.
I don't just randomly show up at a movie theater on Saturday night and be like, what's playing? Oh, is that sold out? Oh, then I can't see that. Okay, I'll see this other thing that's almost sold out and sit with a bunch of, you know, riffraff.
Oh, wow, you don't do that as a film critic? That's so bold of you, Dave.
I'm
How unusual that someone who follows film for a living wouldn't just amble up to a multiplex on Saturday night and be like, what do you got?
I'm trying to explain to everyone that I am an elitist.
We know.
A coastal elite.
Oh, we know.
I don't want to be near any of you in the movie theater. And this is pre-virus. Not into it.
You were always a fan of social distancing.
I barely want to go with friends to the cinema. Like, you are fine because you don't bother me. Like you will stay. You'll look at your phone and play the boing boing game for a while, and then
The movie starts.
Before the movie starts, let's be clear. That's what I'm talking about. Before the movie starts, I can read my book if I have my book with me, or whatever book I have in the car, or you know, I'll look at my own phone and enjoy tweets. But
I at press screenings, I'm your poison taster. When you don't feel like talking to people, you just bury your face in that book, and I have to be the chatty social one.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly what I do. I see people coming up, oh hey, Alonzo. I'm like, read. There have been, I'm not going to name names, but there are professional colleagues in Los Angeles who have known you for longer than 20 years. They've known you since the 90s.
Right.
And who have known me since we moved here from Texas and have never learned my name.
But to be fair, it's only been 21 years.
When they come up to you in a theater, I think, whew, they don't know my name. I will now ignore them. But even, I'll be even more honest, actual friends, people I love, come up and want to talk to you before the movie. And I'm like, don't you know that this is not when I want to be speaking to you? Like, I'm a big fan of you. You're my friend and I love you very much.
It's my special quiet time.
But could you just not, could you go away? Like, I have to read a little something before the movie. I have to be calm and quiet and pretend that I'm alone in a fort that I have built out of
sofa pillows.
Pillows and a sheet and a...
It would be so nice if you weren't here.
This is how I want the cinema to be for me. And I don't want to spend $20 to watch it at home.
Well, you don't have a choice.
I know. Well, I do because we get free screening links from the studios.
We didn't even have to pay the $20. I don't know what you're complaining about.
I'm complaining on behalf of the people that I do not want to sit near or be next to.
On behalf of those who cannot.
Yeah. I mean, it's our job to watch these films, so the studios send us screening links.
Yes.
Generally.
Yes.
Like, I'll be talking about something that I watched earlier this week that I... You know, I paid to stream it.
Yes, a lot of the stuff we've been talking about lately, we have been buying via the websites of, you know, art house movie theaters, film festivals in some cases,
yes.
And you know, I feel very good about, like, that one I don't mind, and it's never 20, it's always like 12 max, but
yeah,
I feel good about that ticket because I feel like these...
Oh, I spent five.
Well, for that thing, yeah, we'll get to that.
That thing.
But I feel good helping out these sort of shuttered institutions that can't be right. open right now.
Yeah.
But yeah, this is just, you know, in the regular places.
Yeah.
Anyway, the High Note.
The High Note is a charming,
yes,
sweet, funny film.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I was sort of dragging my feet.
The trailers are not good. The trailers make it, are selling you something dumb. Did you see the trailer?
No.
Didn't we talk about it on Linoleum Nights?
Oh, maybe we did.
I think we did.
I don't remember.
I don't remember.
That's how inconsequential that trailer is.
I don't remember what's in it. I just remember thinking, I don't really, okay. But it does not sell what you get, because what you get is really quite charming and funny.
Tracy Ellis Ross plays Diana Ross.
sort of.
And plays Diana Ross if Diana Ross only became famous in, like, the 80s.
I was going to say, yeah. Plays like Diana Ross on the Anita Baker timeline.
Yeah, yeah, exactly, exactly. All right, so she's playing a very famous, you know, pop star who has a catalog that's deep and has a huge fan base that has stayed with her all this time, but hasn't had a hit recently and hasn't recorded an album recently and is trying to figure out what she wants to do next. And so her manager, Ice Cube, and her record label are trying to convince her to do a variety of things, such as a Vegas residency.
Mainly it's the Vegas residency, so they're trying to convince her to do.
They also talk to her about a remix album, and Diplo has a cameo as an obnoxious remix producer who's, you know, up his own butt. And
there's a great line about how, like, I've had the greatest hits album and I've had the live album, and now you want me to do a live greatest hits album?
Right. So, in her life, she has two additional people. She has June Diane Raphael. Raphael or Raphael?
Raphael.
Raphael. As the woman who manages her actual home, and who is vapid and obnoxious and silly and... in real life would not have that job, because you want an efficient, no-nonsense person.
Sure.
And her character is all nonsense, but you go with it because it's a comedy, and she brings it every time.
Absolutely.
That she's in a scene. She also has a personal assistant played by Dakota Johnson. Dakota Johnson's character is an aspiring record producer herself.
Yes.
And who is, in her spare time, actively pursuing...
Kelvin Harrison Jr.
Kelvin Harrison Jr. to produce his music.
Yes.
And without Tracy Ellis Ross knowing it, has taken the tracks for her new record and mixed them and produced them on her own, and wants Tracy Ellis Ross to hear them. So all of these things combine to form a series of problems.
Yeah.
And then a very sweet and good and happy ending for everybody.
Yes.
That's not a spoiler. What did you think was going to happen?
Exactly.
And I won't give away plot details, because even though you'll see a big...
some of them coming.
You'll see the biggest reveal coming a ways off.
Yeah.
And it's the kind of big reveal that makes you... If you weren't already invested in the kindness and the pleasures of this film, which is a very gentle, sort of pleasurable film.
Sure.
No one's pitted against each other. There's no one furious with anybody.
It's a dreamy Los Angeles.
There's no rivalries. If you weren't already invested in that, you would think to yourself, I'm sorry, is this like the Crash Los Angeles, where there are 14 people and they all intersect with each other constantly? And the answer is, yes.
In all parts of the city.
It is, yeah. They go all around the city. And let me tell you, as a Los Angeles movie, it's like a Valentine.
Oh, it's the Chamber of Commerce.
It is a Los Angeles full of strivers who are nice.
Mm-hmm.
and who are...
And people getting big breaks.
People getting big breaks and people helping each other and stuff. It's like what Hollywood, the movie, the TV show, wishes it had been. And so...
On Breakfast All Day, we periodically will talk about how there's something so satisfying about movies about people who are good at their jobs.
Yes.
And you get the sense that these people are good at their jobs. Like Tracy Ellis Ross is a singer with integrity, and she can be a diva, but not just for frivolous reasons. She wants her live shows to be like tight, and she wants the backup singers to come in when they're supposed to come in, right, and all that stuff.
Right.
You know, Dakota Johnson is good, clearly has ideas about being a producer, and the movie, I think, does a good job of, even if it doesn't, I'm sure like actual producers would roll their eyes at a lot of it, but it...
Oh yeah, for sure. We have no idea if this is what producers really do,
yeah,
but the movie makes it look like this is exactly what they do.
It conveys the idea of what a producer does, which is an entirely auditory experience,
yeah,
and translates that into a move into terms that we can go, oh, I see what you did. It sounded like this, and now it sounds like this.
Right.
And, you know.
Yes.
So like, I think that is all handled really well. And yeah, you're right. This is just, it's a kind movie, and it's the dialogue is fun. You know, you've got these two sort of second generation actresses. Well, third in the case of Dakota Johnson.
Is granddaughter Hollywood, yeah, royalty.
But yeah, they're both daughters of, you know, and it's just a lovely, like, it is actually kind of the perfect movie to watch at home right now, because
yeah, it's very cozy. That's for sure.
It's so cozy and unchallenging.
And Los Angeles is not a cozy city.
No.
And they make it look like it is.
They do. Like, I think not since maybe 500 Days of Summer has LA seemed so mm-hmm. homey in a lot of ways. Yeah, I was delighted. And
homey as in mansions.
Well, that too, but I just, you know what I mean.
Yes.
Also, Nishika Natra, you know, queer South Asian American filmmaker.
Yes.
I love that she is out there doing stuff, because like I remember when I was the Advocate in the ooze, she had this sort of breakout indie with a film called Chutney Popcorn.
Yeah.
And then, as so many indie female film directors who have their breakout movie do,
yep,
she did a lot of television.
Right.
And she was very good at it, and, yep, you know, all that. But, like, you want her back in the big chair. And she had late night, from last year, I think people had a lot of high expectations for. Amazon spent an insane amount of money on it.
But it eventually found its audience and did okay, right?
It wasn't like it was a flop, but I think
I mean, it's not a good movie, but it's, like, not a terrible movie either.
No, I think it did okay, but, it, you know, when you spend that much, you're expecting to make lots and lots more.
I understand.
I was disappointed with it on a script level.
Yes.
I know about as much about writing for late night television as I do about music production, but even I was like, that's not how
that seems
comedy
wrong.
Works.
I mean, there are a couple moments in this film.
Yeah, you noticed a few.
Where you go, hey, now wait a second. Like,
on Earth.
So many, yeah. And fortunately, it happens early on when they're offering her these options of the residency or the remix record. And she's like, no, that's not me. And I'm like, ma'am, it is you. You're an aging diva. You are Madonna. You are Kylie. You are Diana Ross. You are
Toni Braxton,
who, by the way, all of them have had remix albums. Yes. And so, like,
I don't care how ballady Unbreak My Heart is. We're going to
pump up
the jam.
Who remembers the ballad version of Unbreak My Heart? You do the club remix of Unbreak My Heart.
Well,
who knows the ballad version of Nobody's Supposed to Be Here? You know the club, you know, anthem version.
I bet you, like, the Coast 103.5
maybe
stations out there play the ballady version of Unbreak My Heart. But yeah, you're right. Like,
these would have happened.
Yeah, would have happened already.
These things would have happened.
This would have been...
She would have done the Vegas residency for like 6 months.
Yeah.
And then had the rest of the year to work on her other album. Like, she would have done all of these things.
But at the same time, they address the very true thing about how difficult it is for a black woman over 40 to have a number one album.
I did some research.
Uh-huh.
Would you like to hear it?
Please.
Okay. There's a scene in the movie, and it encapsulates exactly what she's talking about. And the reason I prefaced it with these things that didn't quite ring true was that it is followed by a thing that rings really true. and is the actual point of the film.
Yeah.
To be a woman in entertainment is to have other people telling you what to do.
Right.
And when you do your own thing and when you refuse to let people tell you what to do, then you're difficult, then you are unrewarded.
Right.
You know. And so one of the things that Tracy Ellis Ross says is, I'm, what, a 40 whatever.
Yeah.
And she said, there are like four women over 40 who have had number one hits, and one of them was black.
Mm-hmm.
And when she said that, I thought, oh, that seems pretty accurate.
That's very specific.
That seems very specific and accurate. And I went and I looked that up and I did my homework. Women over 40 with number one hits in the United States. Aretha Franklin, Knew You Were Waiting For Me.
Oh.
The duet with George Michael.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I was thinking it was...
Freeway of Love.
Freeway of Love, thank you.
That might have gone high, but it wasn't number one.
Fascinating.
Tina Turner, What's Love Got to Do With It?
Well, that's two black women.
Well, yeah, this is where it gets a little inaccurate. Now, after the film wrapped, obviously,
uh-huh.
Mariah Carey finally went to number one in 2019 with All I Want for Christmas Is You.
Ah.
But that was 26 years in the making.
Right.
Okay.
Yes.
Mariah is also the first artist to have a number one in each of the past four decades.
That I'd heard, yes.
She is the artist with the highest number of number ones, 19, and the oldest non-white woman to chart that high. She is 49 years old.
Now, is that trio the only, are those all the women over 40 who've had a number one hit, or are there other ones?
Then there's Sia, who had a number one hit with Cheap Thrills.
Mm-hmm.
Madonna had a number one with Music. Bette Midler had a number one with Wind Beneath My Wings.
Right.
The oldest of them all, 52-year-old Cher, had a number one with Believe.
Believe, of course.
Now, this list will almost certainly expand in 2 years when Beyonce turns 40.
Yeah.
Now, for those of you who are asking, what about the men? Well, I did my homework on them too. Four men over 40 have had number ones in just the past 4 years.
And that's not even counting like traveling Wilburys or whatever, right? Like,
yeah, no, we're not. Yeah, this is just solo. This is just the past like half a decade.
Yeah.
We've already had four.
Yeah.
And so, and I don't need to list them because it's all like Bradley Cooper and Billy Ray Cyrus, and who cares?
Whatever.
So then Tracy Ellis Ross says to Dakota Johnson, and you want to be a producer? Can you name a female record producer?
Wendy Waldman.
Well, yeah. But you can count them on one hand.
Oh, I'm sure.
Right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so, does Diane Warren ever produce? She must, right?
I don't know. She might she might be strictly a songwriter.
Right. So in any case, the big point here is women get denied opportunities that men get handed to them. And
if they play it safe, it doesn't mean that they're, you know, like not aesthetically, you know, daring. It just means the cards are stacked against them.
Right. It's just the nature of pop music in general is who's new and who's young.
Yes.
And that's a thing that the film addresses as well, like ageism. And I don't want to make this sound like it's an issue-driven film because it's so breezy and charming and effortless.
Yeah, this is all woven in.
The on-screen chemistry between Dakota Johnson and Tracy Ellis Ross is so wonderful.
Yeah.
Like, they hear each other and they bounce off each other in really wonderful ways.
Johnson and Kelvin Harrison have really great chemistry.
And this is where I was going. Dakota Johnson
is magic.
Might be a sorceress because somehow she shows up in a movie, a good movie, it becomes great. A crappy movie, you're still wanting to watch her. She has this, and I mean, you've got it, it's in her blood, right? Your grandmother's Tippi Hedren, your mother is is Melanie Griffith. Your father's Don Johnson. You've got acting inside you. You know what to do. You've inherited this sort of genetic capability. She is a charisma machine, and I love the way she interacts with other human beings in a frame.
No,
I'm a big fan.
She's wonderful to watch. And also, like I say, on a personal level, this movie really kind of just hit me in the place of like, oh, Los Angeles, I miss you.
I miss going outside in you.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, like there's a scene where they're at the Ford Theater standing backstage. And I was like,
I would normally be there in July for Outfest, introducing a movie,
but that's not happening. And oh, Catalina, I've been saying for years that I want to go there just to go once and see what it's like. Everybody reports back that it's always like, whatever. But
make it look adorable. I hear in real life it's a little janky, but like, they make it look like the perfect chill vibe,
like Martha's Vineyard or something.
Yeah.
So yeah, I had this is not like
Kelvin Harrison Jr. Also. Can super sing.
Yes.
Did not know this. He's been in other films. Didn't know he could sing.
And can be funny.
Is funny.
Because in other movies, he doesn't get the chance. He's been in like real serioso stuff.
Introduce him in a way that makes me think, oh, you're going to be that explaining guy to the woman.
Uh-huh.
And I was worried that the film was going to let him get away with that. But she jumps right in. And spars with him right away, like some old movie.
Yes.
You know?
Well, again, I think this is one of those movies that's like His Girl Friday is sort of a great example of like where people fall in love with each other because of what they're able to do. You know, where it's not just we make goo-goo eyes at each other and then, you know.
Yeah, like, they don't just think that the other one's cute. They have something to talk about.
Exactly.
And they constantly talk about it.
Yeah.
And they're constantly doing that thing together. And so it's a really nice love story as well.
And by the way, also written by a woman, this movie.
Yes.
Flora Greeson.
Yeah.
I think they make that a very smart relationship between two people who bring a lot to the table and admire the talents that the other one has and the shared sort of commitment they have to music in their own various way. This is a lot of fun. You should totally watch it. Also streaming right now on Amazon Prime is a film called The Vast of Night.
And it's been playing in some drive-ins too as well.
I believe so. Yeah. I think so is The High Note. That's sort of the thing that's happening right now is that these titles that are premiering on streaming, the only place they can get a theatrical thing happening pretty much is at drive-ins. So if you live near a drive-in, you could luck out and see these on the big screen. And The Vast of Night would actually be a great drive-in movie. As long as it's dark enough outside.
Really dark outside, because it's a movie that takes place at night.
Yeah.
Yeah.
As the title suggests. This is a first feature, and I think a really impressive one.
It won the Best Narrative Feature Audience Award at 2019's Slam Dance.
Oh, okay.
Festival, yeah.
Director Andrew Patterson, writers James Montague and Craig W. Sanger, all first timers. There's a framing device that I think you could take or
leave. Why don't you first talk about what it's about?
I was getting there. The framing device is that you're watching a show called Paradox Theater.
All right.
And so it's a very Twilight Zone, Outer Limits kind of intro. And it's set in a small town in New Mexico in the 1950s. And there's
the fictional town of Cayuga.
Cayuga, thank you.
New Mexico. In the first 5 minutes, they reference Hobbs, New Mexico. I lived in Hobbs, New Mexico for 2 years when I was a teenager. And when they said that, I thought, wait, are they in New Mexico? Are they talking about Hobbs, New Mexico? And then my next thought was, is there really a Cayuga, New Mexico?
Yeah, I had to Google
I've never too. Heard of Cayuga, New Mexico, and I know a lot of the names of those small towns, because that's all they have in New Mexico is small towns. And there is no Cayuga, New Mexico. No. There is a Cayuga County in New York. But anyway, continue.
Okay, so, small town, everybody is at the basketball game. That's the big thing. But two of the people who are not, who we meet early on, A radio DJ named Everett, played by Jake Horowitz, who works at the local tiny station, and a high school girl named Faye, who's a 16-year-old who runs the town switchboard in the night shift. Her mom, I guess, works during the day. They both hear a strange noise that interrupts radio transmission and can be heard through the telephone equipment. And they start investigating. And
it's a humming, staticky,
weird electrical, you know, static charge.
David Lynch / Conant Project.
Theremin. Kind
of, well, there's no
theremin. Not really theremin, but yeah, the weird staticky thing. So they start investigating, and they begin to uncover the possibility that there have been alien visitors, and that the government knew about it during World War II, especially, and covered it up. And this movie unfolds almost like a radio play in that it is visually dynamic, and there are sequences that feel like long takes but aren't, but where the camera's moving and there's lots of dialogue and conversation and stuff. But at the same time, it is all kind of conscribed to a certain area, and a great deal of it unfolds through conversation. You know, somebody calls into the radio station and talks about having been in these secret missions during World War II, where it was like they would go and get all black soldiers from various bases and just put them on a plane and not tell them where they were going. And they'd have to like dig these holes or whatever. And the idea being that no one would believe them if they tried to talk about it later.
And this sequence in the film is told via a telephone call.
Yeah.
Where you never see the man calling in.
It's all Everett in the station
it's
listening
just,
to him.
You're just listening to a guy tell a story on the other end of a phone call.
Right.
Yeah.
And then later in the film, they encounter a reclusive older woman who has her own story to tell. She is played by Gail Cronauer. Do you know who Gail Cronauer is?
I do not, but I know that you know her.
I took her acting class. In Dallas.
Okay, hold up here just for a moment. What year was this?
This would have been like 1990, 91.
And you had graduated from college.
Yes.
And yet you wanted to take an acting class for local theater?
Yeah.
I wanted to be in local theater production?
I had done...
This is a part of your earlier pre-me life that I don't know very much about at all.
I did a couple of plays with the LGBT theater company in town in Dallas.
What was that? What were they called?
I knew you were going to ask me that.
Do you even remember?
Went right out of my, like, I want to say...
Typical actor. Self-absorbed. Can't remember anything else that
I want to say that it had, like, Lambda in the name. I'm so embarrassed I don't remember.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, and I kind of enjoyed it, and so I took her class, and it was like, and it wasn't like at a college or anything. It was like there was a place that was sort of a local entry point for theater, and they did a bunch of like acting and movement classes and that kind of thing. But it was just its own little thing. But she has popped up in a lot of indies. She was in this really wonderful Andy Anderson film from the 80s called Positive ID.
Okay.
And she's somebody who pops up a lot in Texas-made indies. Anyway, she has this amazing monologue toward the end of the film that makes the story even, like, crazier and, you know, deeper than it had been.
Yeah.
I was just so... I'll tell you, this movie won me so hard in the first 20 minutes.
Can we talk about that first 20 minutes?
Oh, let's.
Because what happens in the first 15-ish 20 minutes is an almost perfect example of world building.
Yes.
And character introduction that is done on a small scale and a very limited budget. But this director, what's his name again? Patterson?
Andrew Patterson.
Has this nerdish attention to detail and has a great ear for the way a very specific sort of cast of characters speak in that they are, this is clearly influenced by Preston Sturges. You know, if Amy Sherman-Palladino wanted him to come in and direct a Mrs. Maisel, he would plug right in. Like, because you've got a bunch of people all walking in and walking around and walking past and talking to each other and handing off items and information to each other. You're being introduced to people. You're feeling like a bit of their little idiosyncrasies in just a few words at a time. Mm-hmm. It's funny. It's very fast paced. Like, you wonder at the beginning of the film, am I going to have to keep up with like 30 people? It reminded me, in a way, of the Romanian film Sierra Nevada, where you are introduced to about 30 people.
And, in an apartment, yeah.
And yes, you are going to have to keep up with all of them. But this one, you actually wind up only having to keep up with like four people and two main people.
Yeah.
But in the beginning, you are introduced to the town. And the town is full of people talking and who have grievances and complaints and rivalries and annoyances and with gossip. Each other, gossip. And you're like, what am I watching? It's wonderful.
Yeah,
to see this go down the way it does.
Like, it was the same feeling I got when I saw Locke for the first time.
Yeah.
And I realized, they're not going to leave the car.
Right.
At one point I thought, if the whole movie is just this, I'm in. Like, I'm just,
if this is going to be a movie about a little town at a basketball game,
yeah,
all sort of
walking around and cross-talking,
bristling against each other in a very, not in an overlappy Robert Altman way, but no, in a pass it back and forth kind of way. It's also, when you get into the story, I think it's this wonderfully sustained mood of mystery,
mm-hmm,
and, you know, a little bit of fear and a little bit of foreboding and a little bit of, oh, this is the way the world is in 1958, nine, mm-hmm, you know, where the man on the phone talking about his experience as a black serviceman in whatever war he's taught, it was World War II.
World War II.
And he says, well, they took us here and they made us do things. And they showed us things that were classified because who would believe us,
right,
if we told anybody we're black? No one's going to believe what we say. And the kid on the phone is like, oh, yeah, I guess you're right. Like, this is white kid.
Yeah, like, and we haven't seen a single black person in this entire movie.
No, there's no one. There's no black person in the town that you can see.
Yeah.
There is a reference at one point, one of the high school kids says something about how the visiting team has four Indian boys. And that's, you know,
right,
what white people said back then. And the, but that's it. Like, so this is very occasionally, but woven into the tapestry of this town, ideas about who gets believed, who doesn't,
right,
who is an outsider and who isn't.
And along the way, like, you get characters. Like, you really...
absolutely.
Everett and Faye become... you've learned so much about them, and there's this nascent sort of, you know, thing blooming between them that's mostly about, again, you know, it's this relationship based on the mind and ability and skill and interests, you know,
right,
even though like all the women around her are like, oh, Everett, he's paying attention, right, to you. And I was like, nah. And she's just not having that.
She's,
you know,
like, I'm leaving this town very quickly as exactly soon as I can.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, there's also, you know, there's a scene where she talks about stuff she's read about in these sort of popular science type magazines about the technology of the future.
Yeah.
And so many times in movies like this, that's a cheap joke about, like, you know, oh, cell phones, no one's ever going to use that, you know, but they do it really intelligently here. Yes. And
it's still funny, and it's still a joke about cell phones.
Yeah, it's a joke that lands,
but it makes sense that these two characters would talk about,
absolutely,
that thing.
But also I think it's a reminder about how people used to be more excited about the future.
Well, yeah.
And there used to be this notion that science and technology were going to bring mankind to this utopia.
Right.
You know, and like, no one talks about that anymore. All predictions are dire.
I really dig this film.
Yeah.
And it's a short one. It's like 90 minutes. And with very limited means, they tell you this really satisfying story. Having said all that, I do not like the framing device. I think it is a distraction.
It
drops itself into the action in the middle of the movie, here and there, for no reason really. I don't understand why it's there, but it doesn't need to be there. But I forgive it.
It didn't take me out. But what's annoying is they'll like suddenly in sort of transitional scenes where people are moving from one place to another, the screen will shrink and it'll go to black and white or whatever. But the rest of the film is in no way shot the way one of those shows would be shot. You've got really smooth camera work. You've got interesting editing. You've got color. And by the way, color that is a million times better than, again, you brought up Netflix's Hollywood, you know, where they're not necessarily trying to look like the kind of color you would see in a movie of that era.
Right.
But it also doesn't look like the kind of color that you would see in a contemporary film. It feels true to this moment, this sort of dusty 50s small town, you know, moment. And so someone put some thought into it.
Okay, so, as we've discussed every week since the virus took us all down the horrible path of life, art house cinemas are just as closed as big multiplexes. But one of the wonderful things that has happened in this time is a glut of art house films. All of them, or most of them, released in conjunction, you know, a collaboration between your local art house theater and the distributor that would have been distributing it to that theater.
Right.
So when you rent those for streaming, they're like $6, $8, $10, $12.
Yeah.
Right. But also, what's happening is some indie art house distributors are just streaming their catalogs on their sites.
Yeah.
And so if it was released in 2016, 2015, 2017, whatever, it's on their site.
And even, you know, like classic films that have been restored in for various reasons over the past few years.
Yeah.
So stuff from the 40s, 50s, 60s, that's like new 4K or a new 2K or whatever.
Things that would have been released, reissued in art house, you know,
theaters.
Yeah, theaters. There's a Visconti film that's out right now, making its way through the streaming world, but as a collaboration with art house films. I'm blanking on the name of which Visconti film it is. It is not Rocco and His Brothers.
It's not Senso.
But you should watch Rocco and His Brothers. Anyway, my beloved Grasshopper Films. They have taken upon themselves to release a bunch of Jean-Marie Strobe and Danielle Huillet films. Their first color film, 1969-1970, is currently streaming on the Grasshopper site for $4.99. Such a bargain. Now, I came to know the films of this couple. They were married for decades. Danielle Huillet passed away a couple years ago. Jean-Marie Strobe is still with us. We reviewed his new short film that is streaming like about a month ago or so, I guess.
What, Paris Against the Robots?
Yeah.
Is that him? Okay.
Yeah. And so you have now seen
a
10-minute film by Jean-Marie Strobe. So anyway, they how to describe them? Extremely demanding. They have an exceptionally serious reputation. And a very limited audience. I guess that's the best way to...
I have delegated you as our spokesperson and liaison with the the films of Strobouillet.
So anyway, they co-directed films for their entire career. And now Jean-Marie Strobe is directing things on his own. And he's like 90. Now he's super old. Still making movies. So the film I watched from 1970 is called Eyes Do Not Want to Close at All Times. But there's also a longer title. Eyes Do Not Want to Close at All Times, or Perhaps One Day Rome Will Permit Herself to Choose in Her Turn. It is also known, some places, as Othon. Here's why. Othon is a 17th century French play by Corneille.
Duh.
I don't know how you say this person's name. And it is a story based on reality. Marcus Salvius Otho, in the year AD 69, murdered his higher up, Servius Sulpicius Galba. This really happened. And Othon had himself proclaimed emperor of Rome. Now, the play is about two young women who are both in love with Othon. And it is a play about the way that the lust for power and the need for, you know, great tragic love require different things. You know, they demand different
sacrifices.
They demand different paths. Mm. And so that's the story, right? But this is a Strobouillet film. So the story is only one component of the film. The film itself is very much in keeping with what Strobouillet did. They were always adapting classical literature or even contemporary literature. They would adapt
Antigone.
Books. They would adapt plays. And throughout the 70s particularly, they were really into adapting like ancient classical stuff. Mm-hmm. So they were on holiday in Rome, and they went to the Palpatine Hill. And they were like, let's make a movie here. So they made this movie at the very location in the ruins where it would have actually happened in AD 69.
Where the performance of the play or where the actual murder?
Where the actual stuff went down.
Oh, wow. Okay.
But this is a 17th century French, you know, play. And so they take all these Italian and German and, you know, other actors, only two of whom speak French. And they all are reciting French dialogue.
Oh, boy.
In these ruins, wearing togas and stuff, while planes and helicopters fly overhead, and you can see, literally see,
tourists
and traffic below them on the streets.
Something tells me Strobouillet would not be a fun couple to go on a vacation with.
Just I don't know. Hunch. I think they might be a lot of fun to go on a vacation with. So,
karaoke again.
So you've got this ancient Roman setting against modern Roman externals.
Mm-hmm.
They set the action in literal historical ruins.
Right.
And then the whole film is this sort of dialectical juxtaposition of things, right?
FSL.
So you've got the real versus the artificial in the sound design. People are reciting this, you know, prose play where it's this rhythmic French that rhymes.
Oh, boy.
Okay. But you've got car and plane noises interfering. Or in a later part of the film, you've got a really loud fountain that they're all sitting next to. And it's competing with their voices.
Well, at least it's subtitled.
You set me up, aren't you? We'll get to that in a sec. We'll get to them subtitles in a minute. This is also a situation in which this very rhythmic, often rhyming dialogue is directed by Straub and Huillet in, I would say, a Bressanian manner, in that they are going for the most emotionless delivery possible. Mm-hmm. They want this dialogue to be recited as quickly as possible and as emotionlessly as possible. So you have all of this friction going on. You've got this oral friction of actors who are speaking in second languages with all of their various accents, sometimes stumbling over French words they can't quite pronounce, making sounds that their own language they're not used to. Then the subtitles randomly drop out at various points in the film, intentionally. Straub had talked about how it was a French film for the French, and he wanted it shown to workers in factories because of its its subversive qualities, because this is a film about rebellion against the state.
Right.
Okay. Now, he claimed that they actually did this, and I'm like, you did not do that.
Because after an eight-hour shift, you really want to watch this.
Let's watch this incredibly, incredibly demanding, rigorous film.
Thank you, but Jerry Lewis is on TV tonight.
So you had to be a French-speaking audience to get even a half a chance at getting all the text. But the actors are speaking French in a way that is often too fast for you to get all of it. And they're speaking it with sometimes really difficult accents that make the French sound weird. And what this means, you know, is that language to this director couple is just another element of the formal aspects of film.
So basically, right? Next to them, Bresson is Nancy Myers.
No. They are just different with a few, similarities in terms of how they get their actors to do the thing they're doing.
Gotcha.
Straub himself plays one of the characters. Mm. And the person who plays Othon, or whatever, how you say his name, is Adriano Apra, who is still alive, a well-known, highly regarded Italian film critic, historian, and filmmaker himself.
All right.
So, what I love about this kind of film, and what I love about this film, is how hard it put me through the ringer. It is 88 minutes, and you work for every one of those 88 minutes. About 10 minutes in, I thought, will I make it? Can I do this? And then I pulled it up from inside of me, and I was like, yes, I will. Oh, will I? I will.
You love a movie that you have to strap across your back and, like,
I can't, listen,
plod toward the finish line.
I'll tell you something. It's a crappy world out there right now. Mm. Outside the door of this apartment, everything is terrible, right? The deadly virus. Mm-hmm. There's an explosion in consciousness about institutional racism. There is a diabolical president.
Yeah.
Who wants to, I think, destroy this entire country.
Yeah.
For the bulk of this time, my film escape has been old musicals, along with my comrade Manola. But, you know, we've been keeping up with the current art house. Like, we watched Liberté and, you know, and some other stuff. I'm blanking on what else we watched. The Plagiarists.
Yeah. Bacurau.
And those have all been, to varying degrees, fairly demanding themselves.
Yeah.
Baccarat is not demanding at all. Baccarat is just sensational pleasure and wild genre violence. It's
art house John Carpenter.
Liberté is pretty demanding.
Woo! That was.
Yeah. But even Liberté will not prepare you for the amount of work that you will put in to this film. And I realized while I was watching it that I love to have to work.
You do.
When I'm watching a film. I realized about 10 minutes in that I was not going to be able to keep up because the English subtitles come so quickly that you barely have time to read them before another big chunk of text is at the bottom of the screen. But then it stops.
Right.
And people are speaking French. You have no idea what they're saying if you don't speak French. And I did not. And I found myself just looking at the traffic and wondering about the traffic and thinking about, like, what a strange thing it would be to have been a tourist who wandered upon this film set and wondering why these people are doing this, you know? And how the whole cast is composed of people who were just part of their colleague circle, you know? Not really actors that I knew or that I know of. Maybe some of them. I love their commitment to being exactly the thing they wanted to be. To throwing you stuff that feels like it shouldn't be together in the same moment. And doing it on, like, every level. On an acting level, on a visual level, because the camera does not move. People stand and recite. And you just watch them do it. It is not dynamic visually. But then, you know, Then you're distracted by a helicopter, and it doesn't matter because the subtitles aren't there anyway. And when it's over, you're left wondering, do I have to go watch this again?
God.
I went back and did a lot of homework after I watched it.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the reviews that I read said, the answer to this film is that you must watch it 5 times in a row. And I thought, what if I did that? What if I did that? Matt Severson, my beautiful, beautiful Matt Severson friend, he just tossed this book and just tossed this book my way by Richard Roud, simply called Strobe, because back in the day,
they just bleeped right over her.
Huh. Strobe was the outgoing one. Mm. She was not. She was like the quiet working one, but she was like the production designer and the editor and the, like, she co-directed. She was the co-director of these films, and right. She did all this other stuff too. But when they would review his films, they would review the film as the new film by Jean-Marie Strobe.
Oh.
Yeah. So anyway, I'm reading this book, And I'm learning, you know, all this stuff. And that's, a film like this pushes me to go do more homework and learn more stuff and understand what it is I'm seeing and why. And I can't get enough.
This is where we are different.
It's like someone's offering me a nice Hawaiian punch. It's a treat.
Great. I'm glad you enjoyed this experience.
Go to grasshopperfilm.com. Pay $5 to watch Eyes Do Not Want to Close at All Times. Actually, you know what you should do? You should start at the very beginning. You should watch Mashorka Muff. You should watch Not Reconciled. Equally baffling until you watch them again and read about them and learn the literary, you know, antecedent and, you know, all that stuff.
Or don't.
But what a wonderful project.
Give yourself permission not to do this if it doesn't
look,
sound like
I have
your
two
kind of
hobbies
thing.
Eating
and vexing me
and making myself watch films like this.
Well, thank you for not making me.
Oh, the day's coming. Oh, no. your turn's coming.
No.
I sit you down and watch The Chronicle of Anna Magdalena Bach.
No, you will not.
I might.
Nope.
You don't know what I'm going to do.
I know what you think you're going
to
do.
You might have to.
I know that I'm going to say no thank you. No thank you.
Can I talk about my DVD streaming Blu-ray pick of the week? This was
sure.
not it. This is the current cinema as far as I'm concerned.
Okay, fine.
Strobe Huillier is the current cinema. They're always modern. They're more modern than you will be in 10 years.
In that I hate the modern world right now, I believe it.
Okay.
What's your streaming pick?
The Curse of the Werewolf.
Okay.
1961 Hammer Horror.
Uh-huh.
Starring young Oliver Reed.
Oh my.
As the werewolf.
We cannot let this episode pass, by the way.
Yes.
Without talking about the death of Larry Kramer.
Okay.
Oliver Reed made me think of Women in Love, which was adapted to the screen by Larry Kramer.
Would you like for Women in Love to be here?
No, okay. But I just want to mention we lost.
You're right. That is the connection.
We just lost Larry Kramer, who was
a screenwriter in addition to being
a playwright and an activist, film executive turned screenwriter turned playwright turned activist.
I just think of him as the guy who saved my life.
Sure.
I don't think of him as the screenwriter, although I should because he was.
Yeah, he was nominated for an Academy Award for his adaptation of Women in Love. He got paid a ton of money to write the terrible 1974 Lost Horizon remake musical, but he took that money and his brother, who was like a stockbroker or whatever, invested it for him, and that allowed him to pursue less lucrative fields like writing novels, particularly the still controversial 1978 Faggots. And then later...
It is still controversial.
Yeah.
And now, I think sometimes even just because of the title. But when you read that whole book,
yeah.
you will learn some things about 70s gays in New York, I'll tell you.
And then, of course, then later writing the Tony-winning play, The Normal Heart, which was recently adapted for HBO.
Kids, in real life, don't say that F word.
No.
It's not nice.
Your Uncle Alonzo gets to say that, but you do not. But
your uncle also.
But his the
you hate kids. You got no uncle.
But I have plenty of nephews and nieces, though. Anyway, he formed the Gay Men's Health Crisis, and then when he got kicked off of their board, he formed ACT UP, and he wrote some brilliantly scathing articles about the AIDS crisis, and that the government wasn't doing enough, and the big pharma wasn't doing enough, and that the gay community, that was one of the main targets of that virus, also wasn't doing enough. And he made a lot of enemies, but he lit a lot of fires under a lot of asses, and he changed the world.
Dude got AIDS in the 80s and lived just out of sheer raging cockroach spite.
Yeah.
And it seemed at times, as I learned about him in the late 80s, it seemed at times that he hated everyone who wasn't himself.
Mm.
And
everyone was disappointing him.
Everyone was a disappointment. And I thought, oh, I would be too. But I'm so glad that A, he lived, and B, that he was the straight up furious person that he was. Because like I said very sort of casually, saved my life. Like, if you were a young gay man in the 80s and you listened to him, he pointed you in the direction.
Yeah. His collection of essays, reports from the Holocaust, was a life changer for me. I would say there are two documentaries you should check out if you want to know more about Larry. There's one called Larry Kramer in Love and Anger that is streaming on the brand new HBO Max, but also on HBO Go and HBO Now.
And if you have HBO, you also have HBO Max, is that correct?
If you pay for HBO the way we do, over most cable systems.
Over your cable system.
You get HBO Max. I think maybe not Comcast for some weird reason, but anyway.
We still have cable.
Yes.
Well, we do a TV podcast, and that's why.
Indeed. So. And then also, of course, the documentary, How to Survive a Plague. Both of those are essential viewing, and you'll get a feel for why Larry Kramer was so important and why it's tragic that he's gone, but, his life really did mean a lot. I'm sorry. Curse of the Werewolf, you were saying.
Oliver Reed's a werewolf.
Enough said.
Come on. Listen, my birthday is this Sunday.
Yes.
But we'll be working, we'll be doing podcasts, and we'll be Zooming with your family and all that stuff. So Saturday will be my birthday celebration.
Mm-hmm.
Here is my birthday celebration. I'm going to bake myself a lemon cake. I'm going to sit down, and I'm going to watch The Curse of the Werewolf. Then I'm going to watch the Kylie Minogue Golden Tour DVD. And that is going to be my birthday, because I'm not leaving this.
Out.
I'm not leaving this house, because I prefer to live and not get the coronavirus. Even before all the demonstrations and protests, and if you are young and hardy, and are taking care of yourself, and are
distancing and masking
somehow figuring out a way to not get breathed on by the wrong person.
More power to you.
Yes. I can't. So my birthday is going to be here at home with you. I like you very much.
Thank you. I'm sorry, I can't make you a cake.
I did marry you after all. Listen, I can barely make myself a cake. Half of my cakes fall.
You made me a wonderful birthday cake.
I did, but I think that's more made a heater's deal than mine.
Still, you
did. I follow a Maida heater cake recipe to the letter, and they come out perfectly.
Nice.
So that is what I'm going to do forever. So I don't expect you to ever bake me a birthday cake. I'm very content to bake my own self a birthday cake.
Okay.
I like doing that. Yeah. Anyway, I've got my birthday all planned out.
Nice.
I'm going to sit down and eat the cake that I made. And I'm going to eat as much of it as I want. I might even make myself sick from it. Who knows?
Happy birthday to me.
I'm going to get myself a nice Hawaiian punch.
Mm.
and I'm going to watch this movie, The Curse of the Werewolf.
Can you still buy it in the metal can? Do they do that anymore?
Probably. Oh, you mean the big metal can, like
yes.
The old high C cans from the 70s? No.
Yes. Oh, okay.
No.
Alas.
So I guess here come the sirens for the day.
Who knows?
Is this starting up right now?
Maybe. It's 4:30.
Thanks, cops.
My streaming pick is a Robert Altman film that I had never seen before. And it turns out it's really been kind of almost next to impossible to see in its full original theatrical form.
Right.
The film is California Split from 1974. It stars Elliot Gould and George Segal as a pair of compulsive gamblers, basically. Elliot Gould has been doing this for a long time. George Segal is sort of slipping into this world. And anyway, apparently for a long time, there was a DVD, but they didn't clear the music rights, so it was like 3 minutes shorter. And so what you're seeing on Amazon Prime now is finally the actual full-bore version of Altman's film. It's really terrific. It's the first movie where Altman sort of unpacked his legendary 8-track sound. So, you know, all the overlapping conversations and stuff really kind of starts with this movie.
Right.
You know, Gould is amazing. George Segal is amazing. I felt tense the entire time because it is a movie about people who are just never satisfied. You know, those gamblers who, like, whether they win, whether they lose, whatever, they keep going. They don't stop.
I cannot tell you the number of hours I spent as a teenager at the dog track with my dad.
Oh, man.
My father was a compulsive gambler. and he loved to go to the track. And so I would just go with him. And
they go to Santa Anita in this movie.
Yeah. I can tell you that it is a tense and nervous-making thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And this is 1974, so everything is covered in nicotine. Anyway, I quite liked it, and I'm an Altman fan and had just never seen this one, so I very much recommend that people check that out. We have a couple letters. Let's do them real quick and close up shop.
We're going to have to if these sirens keep going. Gary Cotty just texted me and told me the National Guard is outside his door.
Oh, great.
Can we just do letters next time? If this is what's going to start happening, I just want to shut off.
Fine.
Do you want to keep? I'll do it. Right. I don't hear anything right now.
Okay.
I'll do it. All right.
Roll the dice.
Daniel says, regarding the West Side Pavilion.
Yes.
We were talking about that last week.
They tore down the inside, and they left the outside.
He says, my understanding is that the West Side Pavilion is going to become creative offices, whatever that means. I think Google has leased most of it. As we mentioned in the last time, the West Side Pavilion was the set of the film Clueless when they did the mall scenes and Tom Petty's free-falling video. Subject line, well, Broadway doesn't go for booze and dope. This is a long one, and I got to put on my glasses. Sandra from Vancouver here again. As you may hopefully know from my subject line, by the way, hello again, Sandra from Vancouver. We love your letters.
We do.
As you may hopefully know from my subject line, that is an infamous quote from the cranky, fading stage star, Helen Lawson of Valley of the Dolls.
Yes.
Recently, my dear friend, Nisia? Nisia? N-I-S-I-A. That's a cool name. And she and I did a rewatch of this film. She sent me a YouTube doc about it that I must watch. She couldn't rave about it enough, so I'm watching this thing from 2006, and who do I see on screen but Alonzo? It's true.
It was a DVD extra from a previous iteration before the Criterion one.
Yeah, from the 2006 release of the DVD, where you were in the making of doc, but the sort of cultural history explanation documentary that comes with it, with your short hair and
it was all one color.
Yeah. She continues, that was such a trip. So obviously I'm a fan of both of you. I write letters, interact, and I love most everything you talk about and recommend. It's one of those things where I am on your frequency in common interests and humor sensibility. As perhaps mentioned before, I feel like we are old friends at this point. We are.
Indeed.
Sandra. Nisia, I'm just going to keep pronouncing her name this way. I'm sorry if I'm screwing it up. However, isn't as much of a podcast listener, so wasn't aware and just wanted me to write to you and tell you how much she enjoyed you, Alonzo.
Oh, thanks.
She said, and I quote, he's so witty and funny and insightful, you have to tell him.
Oh, well, thank you, Nisia. I appreciate it.
I tell him that every morning when he wakes up. I say to him, wake up, lover. You're so witty and insightful and funny. Now get your ass up out of this bed and go make me some money.
And take down the garbage.
Take the garbage down. And to that end, we had another question. Clearly, we get that it's a movie about the women, and it's no surprise the doc you made, as well as much of the discourse available, focuses on him. The men are so irrelevant, they are almost intolerable. That said, though, I can't get one of the many stupid songs in this movie out of my head, and it is the one that wasn't talked about on the documentary. It was that ridiculous Tony Pollard Lounge Lizard performance of Come Live With Me.
Ah, yes.
Come live with me and be my love. I've seen this movie a lot, thanks to Alonzo Duralde. It's where he supposedly falls madly in love with Sharon Tate at first sight while singing it at her. But the song is so dumb, I couldn't stop laughing. It reminded me of Bill Murray's hilarious Nick the Lounge Singer on SNL when he sang Star Wars. It's that over the top. Do you feel the same? Yes, we do.
Yeah, you're not wrong.
Love is a flower that lives for an hour and
then withers and dies. What is the prize? I'll tell you, if you get that DVD, and this might even be on the Criterion, there's a hilarious extra where Army Archard, who was a columnist for Variety for years and used to MC the red carpet of the Oscars for a long time, goes to Venice, Italy for the premiere of the movie that happened on a cruise ship. And there's a scene where he's sitting in a gondola and Tony Scotti sings Come Live With Me to him. By the way, for everybody who loves Valley of the Dolls, and I think there's a lot of you out there.
And you should.
Today, Stephen Ribello's amazing new book, Dolls, 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 Deep Inside Valley of the Dolls, the most beloved bad book and movie of all time.
Our wonderful friend, Stephen Ribello.
My dear friend and mentor, Stephen Ribello.
Yeah.
This is his new book. It is out today.
He wrote the book about Hitchcock that became the movie.
Hitchcock.
About Hitchcock.
Yes. Yeah. Hitchcock and the Making of Psycho. This book is a delicious, deep dive into the writing of the book, the making of the film, all the gossip, all the backbiting, all the almost casting close calls, how it was you know, loathed by critics, how it was loved by audiences, how it went away, how it came back, everything. It's the most, I devoured it in like a day. I will go back and reread it more slowly, but I just was, it was like the chocolates I couldn't stop stuffing in my mouth. Anyway, it is now available. It's a Kindle. It's
hardback or paperback.
Paperback book.
It's a paperback. Yeah.
And he's going to come on the show to talk about it.
Well, he's gonna. We're gonna do a
special episode.
We're doing a little special mini episode
with
him.
Yes. We're doing
just him. Just talking about this.
Yes. Yeah. So be on the lookout for that. But yeah, Stephen is one of our just. We adore him. We love his writing. If you read the Bad Movies We Love book, he co-wrote that with Ed Margulies.
Yeah.
And this book is, there's a line in the trailer that, you know, that Jacqueline Suzanne's bestseller is the movie you wanted it to be. Dolls, Dolls, Dolls is the book I wanted a book about Valley of the Dolls to be. So do pick it up.
Nathan writes, Dear Alonzo and Dave, When I started out in my career as a film professor, I felt a weird pressure to answer the what's your favorite film type question with default academic answers.
Mm. Like Strobe Huye or something.
Though I do... You shut up. Though I do think people... You shut up, love of my life. That's what I should have said about that.
I'm witty.
Though I do think people should see the likes of Citizen Kane and Amarcord, I wouldn't say either are cherished favorites of mine that I would pop in to watch on a whim. Oh, you know who will pop in Citizen Kane to watch on a whim? Alonzo Duralde.
It's true.
Yeah. Over time, I've grown more comfortable in my own skin, but I do think there is a cultural nagging that remains for film fans to like certain movies and bemoan others.
Sure.
This industry brainwashing, of course, starts at a young age, as I'm always disappointing 19-year-old film nerds when I explain why I no longer watch or care about the Academy Awards. It breaks them a little.
Word.
I'm curious if either of you cinephiles ever internally struggled with your place in cultural taste expectations and how you overcame your own doubts with why you like what you like.
I mean, sure. I think in both directions, like a movie that I think is entertaining or valuable that other people roll their eyes at, or a movie that is considered to be, you know, an indelible part of the canon that I'm sort of lukewarm about.
Right.
But, you know, I think that after a while, like you said, it's about being comfortable in your own skin. You just sort of be like, well, this is how I see things and I'm not wrong, you know, and so you just sort of own it.
I can attest that Alonzo Duralde is very comfortable trashing masterpieces that I know are masterpieces. Visconti's The Leopard, which he was annoyed by.
Beautrevai.
Claire Denis' Beautrevai, which is one of my all-time favorite films. Can this marriage be saved? I think is the question. No, but you don't shy from anybody about this stuff.
And nor do you. You're no shrinking violet.
You know, because I grew up punk rock in the 80s, and if you don't like what I'm down for, then I don't care. Having said that, that means that, you know, one of my all-time favorite films is The Poseidon Adventure. One of my all-time favorite films is Destroy All Monsters.
Oh, heck yeah.
These are genre films. They are not considered serious, but they're both amazing.
Yeah.
In the way that they need to be. And they are both cinema in a very real sense. They are as much that as Citizen Kane. They are as much that as Lucchino, as Visconti's The Leopard. They are classics. And deserve to be treated that way. And I love them as much as I love O Hussar Baltasar. You know, you ask me my favorite film of all time, I'm going to distill it down to the one that I admire the most and the one that also means the most to me, and that's Baltasar. Mm-hmm. But I need different things from different films. And so I need Destroy All Monsters. Because part of me is always going to be seven. You know, I need the Poseidon Adventure because part of me is always going to need to make sure that the go bag is by the door and filled and ready for my escape when disaster strikes. Like, you can't get away from your own biography informing what you love and why.
Yeah.
And why should you?
You know, and like, for example, Singing in the Rain is a movie that the them has decided is allowed to be taken seriously, even though it is in a genre that is often sort of, you know, looked upon as, if not disreputable, certainly not, you know, capital C cinema. But that is a movie that has all the things that I love, whether it's, you know, the colors and the choreography and the music, you know, or just the sort of love of movie making itself.
Yeah. He continues.
Yes.
That said, I'm also providing my top 10 favorite films for you to knife.
All right, then.
Because while one should create one's own taste in art, it never hurts to have it put under a microscope for inspection.
Bold.
Top 10 favorites in no particular order.
Okay.
Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Well, sure.
Yeah. He says, the plotting of this film is second to none, not a moment wasted.
Mm.
Advice for people writing in their lists. If you're going to add commentary, make it brief and to the point like Nathan just did.
So that Dave doesn't skip it outright.
So, because I'll just skip it. If you go on, I will not.
Yeah.
That's what's up. Can't be reading your essay on every damn movie on your list. Charade. That sound is the sound of Alonzo having pleasures.
The Stanley Donen and Audrey Hepburn trilogy.
Yeah.
You can't go wrong.
This movie goes from quirky to romantic to thriller and back like lightning.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The Birdcage.
No.
Here's what he says. I would not say character motivations have aged well, but the acting is so charming and Hackman may steal the show as the conservative senator. That's pretty much just a big baby. That's pretty much just a big baby. Sound familiar? The senator who's a big baby.
Right, right.
Sound familiar? You know, not my thing. I saw it in its initial release,
yeah.
And I was like,
Yeah, it's one of those movies that I think...
You caught me before I caught a hold... You caught me after the new queer cinema. Sorry, movie.
Exactly. I was going to say, if it had come earlier or maybe even much later...
Yeah.
But at that moment, it was so not the movie I wanted or needed.
I was all about hating all the gay movies of the 90s because they were not where I wanted this world to go.
Yeah. More Greg Araki, please.
More Todd Haynes. More Jenny Livingston. More...
Rose Trochet.
More Rose Trochet. More weird as hell things like Swoon. Mm-hmm. You know? That was where I was at. More Bruce LaBruce, for that matter.
There you go.
That was my deal. And I was not in for the happy face.
Not to hijack Nathan's list, but speaking of queer movies.
Yeah.
You guys. I'm going to be on TCM.
Turner Classic Movies. Alonzo Duralde is going to be on Turner Classic Movies introducing films.
On Friday, June 12th.
With Dave Karger, who's also a gay.
Yes.
Two gays in one room.
We are celebrating Pride.
Well, actually, two gays in two rooms.
In two rooms,
because you had to record it.
It was all virtual.
It was all done with a ring light, an O-light? What do they call them? A
ring light, I think.
TCM sent you a ring light.
They did.
I'm looking right at it.
Yeah.
It weirds me out.
It follows you around the room.
I don't like it because it's too bright in my eyes and I feel like I'm being interrogated.
No, you're
but
a baby.
You're an old hand at being on television.
Anyway,
so you're better at that than I am.
You know, Deborah Cox is not coming to your town to do Pride because Pride is not happening this year, but you can enjoy it on cable.
She came to LA Pride and she sang, again, she sang Nobody's Supposed to Be Here. She sang that club version.
Oh, yeah. Not the ballad.
All the way, start to finish, effortlessly.
Oh, that was effort. She just didn't let you see
it. It was effort, but she'd already done it so many times that it was like,
I guess so.
Falling
muscle
off a
memory.
Log. Yeah.
Anyway, so Friday, June 12th, Dave Karger and I will be introducing George Cukor's Our Betters, as well as Victim and Word Is Out. And then tune in again on the 26th, Friday the 26th, when our good friend and amazing LGBT film critic, the woman who coined the phrase New Queer Cinema, B. Ruby Rich, will be screening Machen in Uniform, The Watermelon Woman, and Orlando.
Yes.
So Yeah, more to that earlier list. More Cheryl Dunier.
I'm stoked for you to be on Turner Classic Movies.
I am too.
My favorite cable channel, and you're my favorite film critic.
Well, thanks.
I mean, I have to say that because you're my husband.
Yeah, you better.
Yeah,
I'm real pumped about this. So please tune in.
It's already been shot. He wore his nice plaid shirt.
You guys, I don't know who's got cable anymore, but you know, find someone who does.
Yeah.
Have them TiVo for you. I don't know how this works.
But. No one has TiVo anymore. We got
I know.
We got dunked on for having a TiVo still. I will not be ashamed of having
me neither.
A TiVo.
I said
I love my TiVo.
Ironically.
I will love it until they make you replace it with something else.
Yeah.
But we still have cable. We still have TiVo. We've got all the channel.
We also stream stuff.
We have to because,
we've
again,
got one foot in every
this day. Is our job after all. But indeed. You know, there's something very comforting about having shows waiting for me in the DVR.
Absolutely. Okay, Nathan's list. Continue.
Alien.
Sure.
A movie that proves we should listen to women.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. Brazil.
Yes.
It makes me laugh as much as it depresses me.
Mm.
Honey, I Shrunk the Kids.
Okay.
It feels like one of the last practical effects heavy blockbuster family films, and it has heart.
I can't argue with any of those things.
You know, I don't hate Honey, I Shrunk the Kids.
No,
I saw
either.
It, had a good time watching it.
Yeah.
You know.
Haven't thought about it.
Haven't thought about
time.
It since 1989 or whenever it came out. I don't know what year it came out, but.
Yeah.
Who Framed Roger Rabbit?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Talk about practical effects.
Yeah. Such a fun movie.
Yeah.
And, you know.
One of the, maybe the my, last great
my
Robert
beloved
Zemeckis
Bob
movie?
Hoskins. May he rest in peace.
Yes.
Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory.
Oh, yes.
He says, I'm not trying to gain points with Alonzo. It's literally a favorite.
All right.
I won a state competition in middle school with a computer project on Willy Wonka.
Mm. Well, all right.
The Rocketeer.
Okay.
I like The Rocketeer.
It's fine.
I don't remember much about it, but I enjoyed it when it came out.
The one thing I remember that annoyed me about The Rocketeer was that... Terry O'Quinn plays Howard Hughes.
Yeah.
Jennifer Connelly was in that movie at her most voluptuous.
Yes.
And Howard Hughes never comments upon that. And I thought...
And you would think they would.
Yeah. I thought there should be some sort of subtle joke here where
Howard Hughes was nothing if not all about the voluptuous lady.
Yeah, where she should have become in the world of this movie like Jane Russell, basically. But it was Disney. They didn't go there. But yeah, no, the Rocketeer is fine.
His little thing that he says is... It wasn't lies, Jenny. It was acting. Timothy Dalton eating all the scenery. What about Bob?
Okay. Boy, you really like Disney of the late 80s
like
and early
what you
90s.
Like. Touchstone.
Touchstone, Hollywood, all of those.
He said, I had severe anxiety in middle school, and weirdly enough, I connected with Bob, learning to live and let go. I guess baby steps worked for me.
Well, okay then.
Do you know what I've never seen?
What about Bob?
What about Bob?
Oh, we should.
Yeah.
It's fun.
I'm going to say that this list is 90% knife.
I agree with that.
We're not giving you the birdcage because we hate it.
We do. Sorry. But other than that, stellar work.
We're done.
We are.
Hey, we have a Patreon.
We do.
If you want to hear more shows... You want to buy more content? You subscribe at any level that you want, and you get some extra podcast or some extra content.
Yes.
There is Linoleum Knife Presents More Linoleum Knife, where we watch an old movie and talk about it in more depth than we do here. There is LKTV, which is. About television, there is Linoleum Knife and Fork, which is about food, because we have no qualifications to do that. We just like to eat. There is Linoleum Nights, where we talk about anything we feel like talking about, sometimes politics, sometimes not. It is patreon.com/linoleumknife. If you would like to know more, you will go there and find out about it. Now we are finished. I do want to tell you, Alonzo Duralde, that... I have been in misery for a while now because of all the turmoil in the world. And talking to you about movies for 90 minutes takes me away better than a weed gummy. It is a pleasure to have this discussion with you. I forget about my troubles. I forget about the troubles of the world. And I am lucky to have you in this apartment.
Well, thank you, Dave White. You are keeping me sane for sure. And yes, I enjoy these little chats that we have with microphones between us. And I hope the listeners do too. So you guys, thanks for listening. Check out our friends on the internet. There's so many people out there creating amazing shows. See what Bibbs and Whitney are up to at Critically Acclaimed. Check out The Schmoes Know, Dennis Anuin with Dennis Hensley, The Comics Canon, All Things Cozy, Sewers of Paris, Deck the Hallmark, Big Fat Gay Podcast, Fat Guys of the Movies, The Criterion Cast, Secretly Timid. Check out my other shows. I do a podcast called Breakfast All Day with my old comrades from What the Flick, Christy Lemire, Matt Ashley, and Ben Mankiewicz. And I do a show called Who Shot You with Ify Wadaway and Drea Clark, where we usually talk about new movies. In the last few weeks, we've been going back over the entire Fast and Furious franchise. That's been fascinating. And you know what? I'm not podcasting nearly enough, so I'm starting a new one. So keep an eye peeled for a new show called A Film and a Movie with me and Dan from Deck the Hallmark. That starts on June 10th. And every week we talk about a classic movie and a more recent film that it inspired. Our first episode is with Matt Zoller-Seitz from RogerEbert.com, and we discuss The Umbrellas of Cherbourg and La La Land. And we have a lot of fun guests and a lot of interesting movies coming up, so I hope you will check that out as well. Thank you, Blue, as always, for our wonderful theme music. Visit him at Blutopia on YouTube and Blutopia on Twitter and Blutopia.com, BLEUTOPIA. Subscribe to this show for free on Apple Podcasts. Leave us a 5-star review. We will read it on the air. You can also leave positive feedback in all the many places that this show streams, like Spotify and Stitcher Radio, TheLounge.com, Google Play, CastBox, Podbean. You can follow us at LinoleumCast on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. You can drop us a line at LinoleumPodcast@gmail.com. Oh, and I want to mention, we're talking about other podcasts. I know I talked about it when it first started, but just to remind everybody, over at Maximum Fun, where I do Breakfast All Day, there is a show called Fanti, F-A-N-T-I, that is one of the best pop culture shows out there.
Yeah.
It has the remarkable Travell Anderson, who always makes me laugh and always makes me think about things in a different way. And, you know, they're always talking about just... you know, a very broad examination of pop culture through a black lens. He and his co-host Jared Hill and various guests, always worth checking out. So Fanti, F-A-N-T-I, give it a listen if you haven't already. I love that show. Anyway, times are terrible, but we're here for each other, I hope. So thanks for listening. We'll be back next time with more. Take care of yourselves until then. And until then,
goodbye.